United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for attending this Zoom session. We have two consolidated appeals this afternoon, both styled Benzliff versus Silva, 24-11-896 and 24-12-592. Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Lehtinen, have I pronounced that correctly?
Yes, sir, Lehtinen, but however you prefer.
Lehtinen, okay, very well. Okay, and is our appellant reserving time for rebuttal? Looks like 3 minutes?
Yes, sir, correct.
Very well. Okay, you may proceed when ready. Just recognize that the clock that you see will turn yellow, which is your indication that your time is winding up. When it turns red, if you're answering questions from us, then feel free to keep answering. But if not, then we'd ask you to wind up your presentation.
Understood.
Very well. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Douglas Lehtinen on behalf of the appellant, the respondent in the court below, and the mother of the minor child, Melissa Silva. I was, as you know, reserving 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves the Hague Convention on International Child Abduction. The district court issued two orders, both of which are deeply flawed, ordering the return of the child to Denmark. I'll first briefly address the second return order, which purported to enforce the first return order. Nobody disputes that a district court retains jurisdiction to enforce an order while that order is on appeal. But as our briefings in the second appeal made clear, the case law is clear that the district court is divested of jurisdiction to modify or change any aspects of the order while it is on appeal. And that is exactly what the district court did here. The
first first, can you tell me where is the child and where is Ms. Silva?
Ms. Silva is in the Southern District of Florida jurisdiction with the child.
All right. So is there still an arrest warrant pending against her? And has there been any change to the Danish court's order of child of custody in favor of the father?
There is a European arrest warrant issued in Denmark for Ms. Silva. There has been no change to the custody order granted by the Danish court. It is currently being appealed in Denmark.
Thank you.
You're welcome, ma'am. The first return order included numerous ameliorative measures, the nature and effectiveness of which are a subject of the first appeal. The second return order eliminated all of these ameliorative measures and sought to turn the minor child over to the petitioner for an immediate return.
Can I ask a follow-up question to Judge Abudu's? So
yes, sir.
I've actually never seen this before, and frankly, neither of you guys argue it, so I'm asking it more as a matter of curiosity than anything else, but does the fact that the mother is a fugitive affect at all or anything to do with this appeal?
It does. It affects the effectiveness and of the ameliorative measures. The ameliorative measures as put forth in the first return order included that the child shall not be turned over to the petitioner.
If we are to consider that fact, and I want you to finish what you're saying with regard to that, and I want to get into the ameliorative conditions, but if we are to consider that fact, then don't we have to consider it as part of the fugitive disentanglement doctrine? In other words, if you're arguing it to your benefit, then doesn't the other side get to argue that since the mom is a fugitive, that she doesn't get the benefit of also asserting appellate rights, which is a pretty standard doctrine in both civil and criminal cases?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the analysis of a district court facing a Hague petition is fairly narrow. It is simply a decision, a determination of which country's courts are the proper forum to adjudicate child custody issues. It's a question of which courts have subject matter jurisdiction. So,
I know, but your client's seeking relief both below and here. Part of that relief is to assert a grave risk exception, which is an exception under the Hague Convention that allows sort of to differentiate the status quo or the pre-status quo ante. And you're asking for that relief here, and I understand that. I understand your arguments, and you have some really good ones. But I guess my question is, under the fugitive disentanglement doctrine, where someone is a fugitive and seeks affirmative relief, don't we generally say that we sort of stay our hand at that point?
Your Honor, I admittedly am not well-versed on the fugitive disentanglement or entanglement doctrine. However, I will state that The district court is under no obligation to consider ameliorative measures. Once it finds a grave risk of harm, it can deny the petition outright, end of story. It has no obligation to consider ameliorative measures. But if it does, the district court has the obligation to ensure that they protect the child. The Supreme Court has made explicitly clear in Golan versus Sada 2 years ago, the primary goal of the convention is the safety of the child. So if the ameliorative measures are not sufficient, regardless of why, if there exists a grave risk of harm, the district court should deny the petition.
Well, let me ask you this, just following up, I guess. I mean, I know this is a core, if not the core of the appeal, but how can you really say that the district court made a finding of grave risk when the only sentence, so far as I can tell, in the order that refers to grave risk begins with the word although? You know, although...
Yes, sir.
Silva argues that there is a grave risk. In effect, you know, I find that the Danish courts are well equipped to protect the child.
Understood, Your Honor. The district court did not make an explicit finding as to grave risk. But if a petitioner proves a prima facie case for return and no affirmative defenses exists, it's simple. The district court grants the petition, turns the child over to the petitioner for the return to the country of habitual residence. The existence, the imposition of these affirmative ameliorative measures, which all serve to keep the child away from the petitioner, the child shall not be turned over to the petitioner, not just for the return flight, but while they're in Denmark. When they're back in Denmark, the petitioner will shall arrange separate
dwelling. That fact doesn't seem clear to me from the order. Now, I will grant you that the district court's order is not a model of clarity. I wouldn't use this as a sample for other district court judges, but it sure seems to me that what the district court is saying here is until the Danish court can assert jurisdiction back over this case, these are the measures that I am putting into place. That's how I read the ameliorative measures. And I will concede that I tend to agree with you that their existence seems to indicate at least an implicit finding of grave risk, but I don't see how we read this as all going forward until all time, I am determining custody, despite the fact that I have said the Danish court has primary custody here. All I'm doing here is making sure that we put ourselves in the status quo ante. So I don't know that I read the ameliorative conditions as broadly as you've just stated. Why am I reading it? If I'm right, why am I reading it incorrectly? And if I am right, then does that not undercut your argument?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. Because you said, I am not determining custody, right? So understood, the district courts never are determining custody.
Right.
They're simply determining which court, which forum, should
right.
be the one to determine custody. And if there was no grave risk of harm, and if the petitioner proved a prima facie case, then the child is returned to Denmark in the care of the petitioner. And at the time, on May 31st, there was a temporary full custody order had been granted ex parte in Denmark, a temporary full custody order granted.
Well, you say full custody. What it really is and I think you guys, part of it is none of us are family lawyers here and none of us an expert on this and none of us are Danish law experts, but it gives full parental authority is the way that the order is phrased. It isn't a custody order, and that seems to be different. In other words, one has a parental authority to make decisions for the child that are different than necessarily where the child lives at any given time. In other words, there could be one parent can have full parental authority over a child, but a child can have a split arrangement where they live a few days with one parent and live a few days with another parent. That those things are not inconsistent in family law. Why, I don't understand why it would be inconsistent for the district court to say, until the Danish court can decide these things, I'm having him live with the mother and he has to support and they have to be separate until the Danish court can take care of this. Why is that inconsistent with giving the father full parental authority?
Let me say first off, the district court has no jurisdiction to order the respondent back to Denmark. She's a U.S. citizen legally here in South Florida.
Why?
And
can I ask you why? She sought relief in the district court. The district court, we all agree, the Supreme Court has said, has the authority to enter ameliorative measures. Why can the district court not, in the course of doing this, say, if the child has to be returned and you have to be the one to bring the child back? I don't understand why the district court doesn't have authority in this case to do that very thing.
Because the convention doesn't purport to have authority over the parent. It's only over the child. It's a petition for the return of the minor.
I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm sorry. That might be on my end or yours.
Can you hear me now, sir? Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Mr. Leighton, I think it's on Judge Luck's end. Judge Luck, can you hear me? All right.
It appears to be on my end. You go ahead. Sorry.
I lost my train. The question of...
I believe my recollection, it was about why can't the district court, as part of ordering the return of the child, require the mother to be the one to return the child, if I understood Judge Luck's question.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you did. And because the convention is only purports to apply and to have jurisdiction over the children, it's a petition for the return of the minor child. There's nothing in the convention purporting to tie it to the petition or to the respondent or to a parent. Just as the court would have no authority to order the petitioner to appear in Florida for a certain amount of time to take care of the child. Did that answer your question, sir? Or I guess Judge Luck probably can't hear me.
Mr. Leighton, as much as I hate to do this, I don't want you to lose the effectiveness of your argument. Let's pause and let's see if we can get this technical glitch worked out. I think it was at about 2.5 minutes when this started going sideways. So we're going to put that amount of the time back on the clock. And let me just get our IT people on the line to see if they can get Judge Luck's connection fixed.
Yes, sir.
You shouldn't have to argue to two judges when there are three judges on the panel. So just bear with us. I'm very sorry. All right. Stephanie, can we roll the clock back to 3 minutes? A little bonus time for Mr. Leighton for having to endure that indignity. All right, Mr. Leighton, feel free to pick up where you left off. You might want to repeat the answer to Judge Luck's question, because although Judge Abudu, I think, got it just right, I don't think Judge Luck heard the answer.
Concerning why doesn't the court have a jurisdiction over the mother?
Correct.
And the answer, Your Honor, is because the convention doesn't purport to have authority over the parents. It's a convention for the return of, it's a petition for the return of the minor child. It's a convention for international child abduction. Every remedy is regarding the child's return or potential return to the country of habitual residence. It does not purport to authorize the deportation or the ordering abroad of the parents any more than it would, then the district court could be authorized to require the petitioner to come to Florida for a certain...
What do we make, though, of, and I hope everyone can hear me okay, what do we make of our statement in Barron, a case that y'all rely on a lot, at 1349, that, quote, undertakings, and undertakings are just another word for ameliorative measures, commonly include restraining orders, arrangements for transportation and lodging costs, and sometimes provisions for a child's education. In other words, you're telling me that we say that it's common that you can put a restraining order on someone in a foreign nation, and that is perfectly fine, but asking a mother to travel, a mother who is seeking relief from a court, is asking the child to travel as part of making sure that the child is safe, that is without the court's authority. I'm having trouble understanding why that's not within the court's authority once the parties are before the court and they litigate it in front of it.
It's under the court's authority to order those things in that other country, not that they can order the respondent to return. However, it has to make sure that any undertakings it requires, such as you just described, are guaranteed to be effective. And I'll turn the...
Well, the effective is a different part than authority, because you make both points in your brief. But it seems to me that the court clearly has authority over the parties that are litigating in front of it to order them to do things, and order them to do ameliorative conditions. And that seems to be within the sort of the general realm of what undertakings are allowed under the law.
Well,
no one's deporting her. They're just saying you have to travel with your child and stay with your child during this proceeding.
Yes, sir.
That's what it seems to me. I'm tell me if I'm misunderstanding.
No, sir. I do not believe that ordering the respondent to return is within the gambit of what you just described, of the measures you just read off. And I will point out, just earlier on 1351 of the same case, this court said undertakings may be useful in some situations, particularly in cases where parental violence is not alleged. When grave risk of harm to a child as a result of domestic abuse, however, courts have been increasingly wary of ordering undertakings to safeguard the child. And just prior to that, because the court granting or denying a petition for return lacks jurisdiction to enforce any undertakings it may order, even the most carefully crafted conditions of return may prove ineffective in protecting a child from risk of harm. That's at 1350. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor, and I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Very well. You've got your full rebuttal time. And again, we apologize for the interruption.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kaufman.
May it please the court. My name is Ron Kaufman on behalf of the petitioner below and appellee here, Christian Beinslev, and he's also the father of the child, ISB. The core premise of the convention, contrary to what appellant has told you, is not the safety of the child. It's that the interests of children are best served when it's the courts and the habitual residents that determine issues relating to custody. So the convention is really more of a forum selection type of clause to determine what's best for ISB, the child in this case.
So, counsel, it seems to me that the big issue between you is whether there is an implicit finding of grave risk or not. Because if there is, then what the district court did was have ameliorative conditions in the return order, and then in the enforcement order, it seems to have taken those away, and I think there's some jurisdictional implications to that. If there isn't a finding of grave risk, then these regular other parts of the order are sort of superfluous or additions, and changing them doesn't really have jurisdictional implications. I think those are, that seems to me what this rises and falls under. So give me your best argument why we should not read the district court's first order, the return, what you guys call the return order, as not making an implicit finding of grave risk of harm.
Because first of all, Judge Luck, the judge, although these findings were not a model of clarity that you would use for every district court, he was emphatic and repeated himself. His one concern was how to get the child from Miami to Denmark, and
there was a reason. It's because of the danger that the father posed. Let me just read to you certain parts of the record, and then sure. Please respond to them. So I'm going to read to you 4 or 5. This is from page 80 of the transcript. This is docket entry 59. Quote, if you give it to the father, because I think that would be very disturbing to the child. Page 81. If the safety and welfare of the child were my only concern, I would take her away from both of them, including the father. Page 83. And give it to the father that she hasn't seen in months, because I think that would be devastating to that little child. This is at page 89. I am not going to order the child to be turned over to the father because I think that would be very, very traumatic to the child. The child is about 2, and that would be awful. How are those not findings of grave risk of harm if relief that you were seeking was to befall the child? And add to that all these conditions that were added.
It's an excellent question. The issue that the judge was concerned about was ISB was 2 years old at the time. And what he said and what you didn't read in the context of what he was referring to about being devastating for this child was having been deprived of her father for a year because of the abduction. Just handing her over is going to be creating separation anxiety for a toddler.
I'm not sure that there's certainly that going on. And I did read the whole thing. I just want to be clear. But in page 81, the district judge specifically references the safety and welfare of the child. If that were this concern, I would take them away from both parents. In other words, the district judge is saying that if I'm only concerned about safety or welfare, then I would not give this child to the father. How is that not a finding of grave harm or an implicit finding of grave harm?
First and foremost, the judge was specifically admonishing both of these parents for being lousy parents. Why? Was it the safety of the child because of physical violence? No. What the father had admitted to was that they met at Burning Man and recreational drug use was a part of their life before, during, and after this child was born. That is how to reconcile.
But you add into that, there's a second piece, because you add into all the things I just talked about, and I'm going to read all of them, but there's a few others. You add into that these conditions, which I don't know how to see them other than as ameliorative conditions. And I think your opposing counsel is right. There's no reason to impose those, but for, and I'm not sure there's even authority to impose them, absent a finding of grave risk of harm. Because what the Supreme Court has said is those aren't in the convention. They're only implicitly part of it based on the discretion that a district court has once there is a finding of grave risk, whether to return or not. That's sort of implicit in that discretionary call. But you only get there once you make a grave risk finding. So how do we read those statements I read to you, plus these conditions that are given, to not have some sort of implicit finding of grave risk of harm?
Judge Luck, the key to your question is that when in the United States Supreme Court of in Golan, ameliorative measures could be issued if there is any risk. It did not specify grave risk. In Barron versus Beatty, which we've all talked about, this court, and I could read the quote if I could find it really quick, is one of the few circuits in the country that does not require a finding of grave risk in the event it wants to use ameliorative measures to return a child. And when I use the term ameliorative measures, and when I used it in our briefing, what I'm referring to is this umbrella term that could include everything from undertakings to get protective violence, domestic violence injunction protection, paying for things.
I don't doubt your position on that, but I'm not certain that what you first said, which is that they could impose these for any risk, is true. I'm reading the Supreme Court. I'm reading Golan, and this is at page 678 of the opinion. Under the convention and ICARA, district court's discretion to determine whether to return a child where doing so would pose a grave risk of harm includes the discretion whether to consider ameliorative measures that could ensure the child's safe risk. I don't read the court as saying that if there's any risk, the court can do that. What the court is saying is if it's going to return despite grave risk, it can add in these ameliorative conditions, which it seems to be exactly what the district court did here.
This court in Barron has approved ameliorative measures without a finding of grave risk. And even after the Supreme Court's Golan, it was referring to ameliorative measures for risks, not necessarily grave risks. And that's an issue that's in conflict with other circuits, which do require, in fact, a finding of grave risk before you could actually impose an ameliorative measures. But here, when you look at what the judge was concerned with and repeated it over and over, taking a two-year-old who hasn't seen their father and sending her back with this person she hasn't seen in over a year, that was devastating to the judge. And that was the one finding he repeated over and over and over. And if you consider one of his ameliorative measures, give me a travel itinerary. What does that have to do with safety? That has to do with getting a child, a two-year-old child, to
Denver. But the logistics are different than you can't live with each other and someone has to support the other person. Those are different. Let me ask you this, counsel.
Sure.
Assume that I'm right, that there's an implicit finding and that these are ameliorative conditions. So assume that. Does not the enforcement order rub up against the what I'll call the Griggs rule, that once an order is on appeal, a court can't, absent a motion to alter or amend or a motion to vacate under Rule 60, absent those things, affect the very thing that's on appeal?
So this is the highlight of the case, because what the judge did was take your implicit finding of a grave risk of being with this father and say, the father takes the child.
Right.
Isn't that the
problem? I agree with you. There isn't a way to reconcile it. I think that's why the order was stayed.
Unless Judge Luck, he was never concerned about the safety of the child with the father. He was concerned about a toddler who hadn't seen his dad in 2 years and get on a plane, see ya. That happens every time you drop off a child at daycare. This happens every time there's an exchange of custody and an allegation of alienation. It happens every time there's an exchange at the courthouse when the child is returned.
It seems odd though to use a second order to interpret the first order. But again, you're fighting my hypothetical. So assume that there is an implicit grave risk in the first order. and assume those are the there are ameliorative measures, does not the second order read in that context rub up against the Griggs rule?
It would depend on what the grave risk that was identified by the court. Don't forget there.
Well, but it's not just the grave risk. It's the what we're talking about on appeal. What we spent all this time is the ameliorative measures and their effectiveness. That's the very thing that was on appeal. And yet the district court gutted those. Again, assuming that I'm right in my reading of it. Assuming I'm right, the district court gutted all of those and said, all right, there's no more separation. There's no more support funding. The kid can travel not with the mother, but with the father. The father gets the travel documents, not the mother. I mean, everything changed.
So there's a fact that the panel may not be aware of, because I heard Judge Abudu talk about this. Or maybe it was Your Honor. The custody order that was in place as an ex parte provision by the court in Denmark is not the current order.
I understand.
The judge knew, the district judge in this case knew that there was a judge, that there was a family court, that they had issued an order, and that upon return to Denmark, the judge in Denmark would have full, complete control over custody, and it is the only court in the world with child custody jurisdiction over ISP.
All that's true, but again, I go back, how does the second order not rub up against the rule in Griggs that a court is divested of jurisdiction to contraband the very order that is on appeal, absent Rule 59 or Rule 60?
If Your Honor finds that this my client, the father, was the grave risk of harm as...
Well, I didn't find anything. I can only read what's there, but what I'm trying to do is assume that that is the case, trying to understand what the implications of that are for the second order. Those are the questions I'm trying to ask you. And so assuming there was an implicit finding of grave risk, assuming the district court imposed ameliorative measures, assume that. Does that not mean that the second order contramanded those things outside of the court's jurisdiction under the rule in Griggs?
I think that would be, but I would have to look at what those ameliorative measures were that are under review. For example, a lot of this, in our opinion,
we know what they are. They were that the kid is to travel with the mother, not the father, that the travel documents were to be given to the mother, that the father was to provide support for the mother and live separately from them until the custody court was able to then weigh in. Those were the ameliorative measures. Were those not countermanded by the second order?
Yes. But if the court describes them as ameliorative measures in the sense that there was an identifiable grave risk of harm to this child, and these were imposed in order to protect, then yes. But that's not how we see it. This was mere travel restrictions to get a toddler to Denmark. And what is the court to say now that there is a final order adjudicating sole custody to the father and rejecting the mother's right of access and visitation? Now we have the only court in the world with child custody jurisdiction saying it's safe for the child to be here. It's safe for the child to be with the father. The mother actually no longer has the rights of access. If this court were to reverse and say it's too unsafe to go to Denmark, the court in the United States, which does not have child custody jurisdiction over this child and does not look to do that, is creating a conflicting order with the court which does have child custody jurisdiction.
What doctrine is being implicated there? I mean, we know that mootness doesn't apply. Chafin speaks to that she's filed this petition and it's still a live controversy. But what about the redressability issue for purposes of standing? Or is there some other principle that you're speaking of that needs to be considered?
When Your Honor discusses mootness as relating to the child having been returned already in Chafin, did not moot the appeal. That's not what I'm referring to. The mootness is now that a court with child custody jurisdiction has determined the best interest of the child is to be with the father in Denmark, to create a conflicting order completely undermines the convention. And this is from the 10th Circuit. and I would like to get you the citation.
Right, but Chafin, as I guess maybe we're saying the same thing, didn't have an intervening order from a foreign court like we have now that establishes custody, at least for purposes of the Danish courts. And as I said, again, I'm trying to understand what is the principle or the doctrine that is being implicated given that intervening act.
It would be mootness, but contrary to the Chafin case, the return did not make moot the appeal. And what I'm referring to is now you have a conflicting child custody decree, and this court cannot now tell the court and the habitual residence, which is supposed to decide custody.
Why is this? I'm having trouble understanding why the district court's orders here are in conflict. The district court explicitly in both orders says we are not determining. I mean, you even wrote the second order. We are not determining custody.
Right.
So there's right. No, how is there a conflict?
If the court were to reverse the order and say the child should not be placed with the father at this point,
if we were to reverse the second order, we would just reverse because the district court was without jurisdiction to do what it did. That would be the only basis to reverse.
But placing the child with the mother as opposed and not returning the child to the father in Denmark to the habitual residence, that would create an international child custody conflict, which the convention is designed to prevent.
Okay, Mr. Kaufman, thank you very much for your presentation. Mr. Leighton, you've got your rebuttal time available to you.
Yes, sir. I want to start with just the question of mootness right there and request the ability to offer supplemental briefing on it because it is a complicated issue. Opposing counsel was referring to Navani versus Shahani from the 10th Circuit in 2007. I'm prepared to talk about it, but that would last much longer than 3 minutes. The bottom line is the district court is determining which forum, which country's courts have subject matter jurisdiction. It is incorrect to say no matter what, in all cases, regardless of what this court and the district court say, the Danish courts have subject matter jurisdiction over custody. That is incorrect. That would mean that in every petition for The Hague, you would determine what's the habitual residence of the child, and that would be it. Because then you send the child back to the court of the country of habitual residence for custody determinations. But I'll leave it at that. And if your honors want more, we can
Maybe I think supplemental briefing because, again, so the child, it's a little different. The child and the mother are still in the United States. But let's say that she had complied with the first order that said you have to return the child. And the child is now in Denmark. She's still seeking custody. We know this case isn't moot, but you've got a Danish court that has already established a lot of the underlying issues at stake here. So what do we do?
Because if this court were to reverse, if Ms. Silva were ultimately to prevail in this case, it would be a determination that the U.S. courts are the courts with subject matter jurisdiction to decide child custody issues, and that the Danish courts would not have subject matter jurisdiction to do that. Any other ruling would allow multiple courts, and I think it's actually the reverse, it would allow multiple courts in multiple countries to have jurisdiction. And then it would simply be what the opposing counsel is trying to avoid. It would be whichever litigant, whichever parent gets to the courthouse first. The left behind parent gets an order from his country saying, I've got custody, there would be no purpose for the Hague petition. So it is not a correct statement that no matter what, the courts in the country of habitual residence have child custody or have jurisdiction to determine the child custody issues. That's what the purpose of the petition is, to decide which courts and which country's courts have jurisdiction. So we still, this court, and then if appropriate, the district court, determine which court has jurisdiction. A denial of the petition, prevailing for Ms. Silva, is a determination that the U.S. courts are the ones with subject matter jurisdiction.
To return quickly to the findings of fact regarding grave harm, Judge Lux cited a number of things from the record from the district court, but none of those statements actually appear in the return order. Are those outside the order statement sufficient for purposes of determining that the district court sufficiently articulated findings of fact for purposes of determining a grave risk of harm?
Your Honor, if I may, I'll answer that in two stages. The first stage is the district court did know how to say what it wanted to say. When it addressed the challenge to the exercising of the custody rights by the petitioner, the district court explicitly said the court finds petitioner has shown by a preponderance of the evidence that the petitioner was or would have been exercising rights of custody at the time of removal, addressed the standard, made the ruling. When it came to grave risk of harm, he said, the district court said, although respondent argued grave risk of harm, this court finds that the court in Denmark is fully capable of protecting the child if necessary. There absolutely was no implicit finding that there was not a grave risk of harm. So if this court determines that...
Can I ask you a question? Is the easy answer to that question not on page one of the return order? This is docket entry 46, which states, for the reasons stated on the record, the court finds this, that, and the other. In other words, didn't the court explicitly adopt the statements it made on the record as a way in order to not have to write a 50-page order in a case that had some emergency to it?
Well, I don't believe that. So the district court held essentially a colloquy with the counsel for the respondent during closing arguments, a back and forth, some of them question and answer. And those are not part of the order. You can explicitly show where the court begins its order.
Didn't the court say for the reasons stated on the record? Isn't the, what I read reasons that were given by the district court?
Well, I would say no, Your Honor. I would not include all those. I would not include anything that's stated in the colloquy as reasons on the record, because you had instances where the district court was questioning certain countries and questioning the ability of other countries. And if it was this country, it might be okay. If you're going to accept everything that the district court said in the colloquy, you'd have to give credence to statements like, in an international survey of corruption, Venezuela was considered the second most corrupt country in the world. Those are not findings of fact. Those are not reasons stated on the record. That's a colloquy. That's a discussion. That is dicta. That is not part of the order. And specifically, the district court could have made it part of the order, and it could have said, I find no grave risk of harm exists. The district court explicitly did not make that finding. It either implicitly found it or it attempted to pass that duty on to the Danish court, which is explicitly contrary to Hague law. Danapor must declare the First Circuit 2002 in our briefs.
So I might have gotten myself all turned around here. I sat on a panel this morning, so this is my fifth case of the day, and I'm a little brain foggy. But I think you're fighting off a life preserver that the Judge Luck was trying to throw you. The statements that he read earlier from the oral colloquy, I think, were quite favorable to your position that, in fact, there might be an implicit finding of grave risk. And he invited you to say that, in fact, the district court adopted those into the order. But you've now expressly said, no, he most certainly did not, which leaves us, to Judge Abudu's point, with the only thing on the face of the order being this sentence that begins, not insignificantly to my reading, with the word although. Although you made an argument, I find that the Danish court is capable of protecting the child.
He did, to answer your questions, Your Honor's comment at the end, he found that the Danish court could protect the child. He had absolutely no evidentiary support of that, and he had the obligation to make a finding, meaning whether or not a grave risk of harm exists, not a finding whether or not the Danish government can protect the child. As to the comments made in the colloquy that I've referred to, yes, the district court definitely gave reasons why, explained reasons why he was not willing to turn the child over to the petitioner. And those can be considered as showing how he arrived at the ameliorative measures.
In fairness, a minute ago, you were pretty stridently saying, no, those are dicta. They're like the comment about Venezuela.
But the ameliorative measures are the crux of it, Your Honor. Absent the imposition of the ameliorative measures have no place and purpose outside of a finding of a grave risk of harm.
Okay. All right, well, I think we've carried you well beyond your time. Judge Luck, Judge Abudu, do you have any further questions? Okay. Mr. Layton and Mr. Kaufman, thank you both so much. Mr. Layton, and again, our sincere apologies on behalf of the court for the technical glitch. We appreciate you doing this on Zoom. And be on the lookout for an order from the court with respect to the supplemental briefing that we've discussed concerning mootness or potentially other issues.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.